Hi, my name's Emily Sexton. I'm the Artistic Director of Next Wave. So it's 5 p.m. on Wednesday, the 26th of June, 2013. It's a pretty interesting moment for female politicians, and I guess in a broader sense for women everywhere, and for men. Julia Gillard, Australia's Prime Minister, is going into yet another battle for her leadership position. Tonight at 7 p.m. she's called a poll, and she's interestingly said that anyone who loses should retire from politics at the next election, and that includes herself. We don't know what's going to happen with that. Meanwhile, we were also following Texan Senator Wendy Davis, who attempted a 13-hour filibuster to block a strict anti-abortion bill in America's most conservative state. This failed, although from what we can gather, it's still being contested. In these two women, we see examples of trying to make a difference on your own terms. How do the rest of us do it? This morning's Breakfast Club tackled just this. We propose that what feminism needs is a calmer debate. And it's safe to say that the room pretty much wholesale rejected that idea. And you'll hear more about that next. But today's events show that when it comes to feminism, we do need to talk not about the why or the what, but the how. Must women stand for 13 hours to be heard? So our first speaker is Zoe Dawson. She's a theatre maker based in Melbourne. She's part of a collective called I'm Trying to Kiss You, and it's a feminist theatre collective comprised of Alison Wiltshire, Zoe Dawson and Anna McCarthy. They are part of our Kickstart program. They're a bunch of artists who are making work for the 2014 Next Wave Festival. They've also performed in the Melbourne Fringe Festival and a Node Festival in 2009.
Reasons why I am a feminist. Number one, I believe that men and women have equal human worth. That's it. To me, a feminist is just someone who isn't an asshole, basically. I like to remind myself ways of not being an asshole every morning, and reminding myself that I'm a feminist helps me with that. I suggest this as a jumping-off point, but there's no need to stop there. You might like to remind yourself every morning that you're not a racist or a homophobe. You might like to remind yourself not to kick puppies and not to punch slow-walking people in the back of the head and not to take a shit in the middle of the street and to say thank you to the person who makes your latte or whatever works for you. When I got asked to speak at this event, I felt kind of strange about it because I don't like the idea necessarily of being viewed as some kind of expert on feminism, which implies that I somehow have a great amount of experience and knowledge on the topic of women's oppression, which as a middle-class Australian white woman is clearly not the case. The reason I'm here is because I make theatre, and more often than not, I make theatre that relates to my own life. Because of the way our society is currently structured, my experiences are very often dictated and defined through my gender. Therefore, I make theatre about being a woman. And perhaps one reason why this is automatically politicised is because it is less common for women to take on roles in which they dictate the content that is received by a wide audience. Which is great, and I really love what I do, but I don't think it necessarily makes me a better feminist. The real question I propose to you today is this. Who is the boss of feminism? Who gets to define what a feminist is, or who's a good one, or how to be one, or what one looks like? A couple of years ago, the first Slut Walk protest came to Melbourne, and a large group of feminists, both men and women, took to the streets to protest a culture of victim blaming and slut shaming being consistently levelled at female victims of sexual assault and rape. What ended up happening on the day of the protest was that other feminist groups actually protested the protest. When I arrived at the rally, men and women were handing out pamphlets denouncing the Slut Walk movement and encouraging people to come up the road to their feminist protest instead. It was the poor fighting the poor, and it made me really sad. What I'm hearing a lot of lately is things like, I'm not a feminist because this person over here said something that I don't agree with, and they said that they're a feminist, so I'm not going to be one now. Which makes it sound like the feminists are a football team that you either barrack for or you don't. I hear people say things like, I agree with some of what the feminists say and I don't agree with other things, which makes it sound like there is a leader of feminism who defines and dictates what it is and what it stands for. But I'm going to lay it down for you. There's no leader. There isn't even a head office and a shitty 1970s coffee machine. There are heaps of different strains and types. There's conservative feminism and radical feminism and eco-feminism and separatist feminism and maternal feminism, and there's second wave and third wave and post-feminism. And if you've got no idea what any of that means, I don't care. It's no one's job to quiz you and you don't get extra points. These movements were not put in place or predetermined. They were defined and exist because of people like you and me. And the diversity in feminist thought today is a testament to the scope and variety of people who identify with issues of gender equality, who don't think women should be punished, abused, belittled, or devalued as a direct result of their gender, who want to change things. I think it shows us how unifying these concerns can be across social demographics, religions, race, and politics, and that they're different seats at the same table. And no one person or group can speak on behalf of feminism or claim it or rule it or be captain of it or kick you off the team for having different opinions, and likewise, you can't kick anyone else off the team either. I'm really enjoying the football analogies. Hope that's okay. In my mind, there's a moral code of behaviour that upholds human rights, and outside of that, I have exactly zero to say about how you want to be a feminist and how you do it. At the end of the day, we know the scale's unequal. We know why feminism exists. The UN estimates that women do more than 2/3 of the world's work for 10% of the world's pay and own 1% of the world's property. An estimated 35% of women worldwide have experienced sexual violence. So that's 1 in 3. So if you have 3 or more women in your life that you love and care about, that's a pretty good reason to get behind the cause. And the abolishment of these and other social injustices against women have always been the end goal of feminism in all of its guises, and they are what we must have in our minds as we move forward in whatever way we do so. I think that the next wave of feminism needs to embrace this diversity. I think we need to stop telling each other how to be feminists. As long as our end goal is the same, I think we can benefit from supporting each other, even if we don't always agree. Because the greater the diversity of the players, the stronger the team will be.
Our second speaker is writer-performer Ben McKenzie, and he's best known as a comedian specialising in science and geek culture. And he also has a hit podcast based on Doctor Who called Splendid Chaps.
My favourite quote, which I think sums up how I try to approach it as a man who identifies as a feminist, was written by someone who I don't know their real name because they wrote it on Tumblr, so I only know their username, which is Soul Tired. And they wrote, "Men who want to be feminist allies do not need to be given a space in feminism. They need to take the space that they have in society and make it feminist." And I took that to heart, and I think it's one of the reasons why, I mean, I don't have a lot of influence in most forms of society, but I'm kind of a big deal when it comes to nerds. So my particular area of focus is I look at feminism in geek culture. And it's not just because that's an area where I have influence, it's also because it's an area where I see an appalling level of sexism. For me, there can only be a calm debate when all the people in the debate decide that they are willing to speak calmly. And to ask the question, do we need a calmer debate, is kind of a silencing tactic in a way. And I'm going to use as a case study a panel that cropped up on an upcoming geek event called PAX Australia. They only just released the program for the panels that will be on there about a week ago. And one of the panels was titled, "Why So Serious? Have People Forgotten That Games Are Supposed to Be Fun?" And the original text describing what the panel will be talking about was saying that, you know, why is everyone taking games so seriously? If you put a woman in a game and you don't get it exactly right, they'll call you sexist. And if you put a non-white antagonist in the game, suddenly you're a racist. Why can't we all just get along? Was almost word for word the kind of things that were in there. They are deliberately not asking the question, what do we do about sexism, racism, and other forms of discrimination in games as a culture and as an art form? They are instead asking the question, why do you keep picking on us for being sexist and racist? How come we can't just all get along and have a nice time? So they are framing that as, hey, how come, why don't you settle down and be calm? And so these sort of arguments when you say, like, can't we all just get along, you know, can't we be calmer? First of all, they're a silencing tactic, but second of all, and also relevant in nerd culture, they're ignoring the fact that the people who are making the least calm noises, the people whose responses are the most shouty and the most offensive, are the people who are rejecting feminism, the people who are reacting against it and don't want to accept it in their lives. When you have someone like Anita Sarkeesian, who comes out She's a woman who runs a website called Feminist Frequency. Her whole remit is to look at sexism in popular culture. And she decided to run a Kickstarter so that she could run an extra series. She was already looking at film and TV and literature and had been doing so for years. And she wanted to run an extra series to look at video games. And she ran a Kickstarter asking for some small amount of money. It was about $6,000. And people went, this is a fantastic idea, started giving her a lot of money. And the amount of bile, of violent talk, of shouting her down and telling her to shut up that came from the gamer and nerd community was appalling. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And so my provocation really is, how do we ask people who reject feminism, who react in that violent a way to even the idea of being criticized for being sexist, how do we ask them to have a calmer debate about feminism?
Our final speaker is Dylan Coleman. She's a Gadigal Greek woman who grew up in Thevenard on the far west coast of South Australia. She is the award-winning author of Maze and Grace and has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Adelaide, where she also teaches Indigenous health.
I thought that I might start with a quote from the Dalai Lama. We must recognise that the suffering of one person or one nation is the suffering of humanity. That the happiness of one person or nation is the happiness of humanity. A calmer debate, is that what feminism needs? I believe this question is a very divisive one, and in some ways it's saying, why don't we just let social injustice and inequality continue in our society? Let's just quietly sweep it under the carpet and hopefully it will just go away. For me, my approach to this question is so multifaceted. When I heard it and I told my mum about it, she kind of laughed and said, calm, are you for real? Who wrote this question? Was it a man? So for me, this, like I said, this approach is very multifaceted that I barely know where to begin. I'm an Aboriginal Greek woman who grew up in a rural community with a hard-working, hard-drinking, hard-brawling European father and a strong, proud Aboriginal mother who was fiercely protective of her children and our Aboriginal identity and who has been a considerable influence in my life and my creative work. I'd call my mum a feminist through her actions over the years and how she's demonstrated that women are strong, independent people who can achieve anything that they want, and a calmer debate's not in her repertoire. And anyone who reads Amazing Grace, which is the story I wrote about her growing up on Kuniba Mission in the 1940s and 50s, would know that she was one hell of a feisty child and she grew up to one hell of a butt-kicking woman. But my mother never chose to label herself as a feminist, and that's not to minimise the strong black feminist movement that exists in this country today. There were a lot of women who approached her and said, you need to be part of this. You know, we need equal wages and we need a lot of these things. But the reality for us is that we didn't have the vote until the 67 referendum, so we weren't even considered Australian citizens till then, or we couldn't vote. She basically, you know, said that we needed to all come to a place of social equality before we could move forward with women. So she doesn't call herself a feminist. She believes that this sits within a Western construct and of how we are, and that before Europeans arrived in Australia, our Aboriginal women had our own power and their equal place in Aboriginal society. We had our own dreaming stories, we had our own women's sites, and the men men had restricted access to. And in saying that, in the past tense, many of us still maintain those, as our family do. All of this involved the merging of creative life and sustaining practices where art and survival were one. It was a place of contentment, happiness and well-being, and knowing one's place. It was a place where we were equal. It was a type of balanced existence that Western society strives for today, less work and more time to pursue spiritual and creative endeavours. My mother says the oppression of our women and our children and men faced today as a result of colonisation, with its brutal patriarchal force, and it is largely part of the internalisation of Western value systems forced upon us that we have turned in on ourselves. In all our pursuits, including our creative ones, and in my mum and my case, the writing of her story, and being informed by many black feminists in that process, deconstruction of colonial influences should be at our core. So the question I asked today, and it's kind of asking you to stretch your thinking a little and to move into maybe another positioning than you used to. The question I ask is, what types of approaches to art and politics can bring Aboriginal women and their communities to the centre where we need to be?
So Breakfast Club always takes us to unexpected places. We caught up with the speakers afterwards to reflect on their sprawling conversations with strangers that were inspired by these provocations. Where did you end up at your tables? What kinds of discussions happened there? Ben?
After Dylan's talk, we were really interested in the idea that, you know, before European settlement, First Australians didn't have a patriarchal society. And it's like, wow, that's news to us in a way. Like, we sort of know that somehow on some level. So after the first talk, it was really a kind of discussion about what do we know about that and how do we find out more? And then what do we do with that knowledge? So that was a really good one.
What happened after Dylan's provocation at the tables you were at, Zoe?
Well, we had a similar discussion that a lot of revealing lack of knowledge. There was a woman on my table who was recounting a personal story that she had played the didgeridoo for years before she found out that that was sort of against Indigenous law, and she was sort of mortified to find that out. And we talked about feminism being quite a white woman's movement historically, because that's where it came from, and just the conflict in that way.
Would you see feminism as a white woman's movement, Dylan?
I think historically, certainly when you have a look at the Victorian era, when you have a look at, you know, colonial process with women being so disempowered that it's grown out of that disadvantage. So our fight as a whole community has been different. And but we still, as women in a colonial society, have many issues that are similar to non-Indigenous women. And I think those gaps are closing, but there's still specific issues around, you know, not having representation in Parliament. You know, it's great to see so many more women in the Parliament, but we have so few Aboriginal people that are represented, and the idea around designated seats would help with that equality. And, you know, also ideas around our constitution. You know, we're in the preamble, but we really need an indentured treaty, and we need a Bill of Rights to bring us up, you know, to that level. So I think there's many similar issues with the feminist movement. Historically, it's been very different, but we've still got a way to go to bring Aboriginal people to a level of equality here in Australia.
You talk a lot about your mum, you know, this incredible, strong black woman, and how she's influenced your kind of thinking. I was wondering for all of you, what kinds of people or ideas have influenced your feminism?
Well, that was one interesting thing that came up after Dylan's talk, is that both myself and Alison were heavily influenced by the writing of black feminists in America. Like, the book that changed my thinking about feminism was Bell Hooks' book, Feminism is for Everybody, which I don't actually think fulfills the promise of its title, to be honest, but it really was a light bulb moment for me. And part of that was the intersectionality of it, how she talks about how feminism has to be a global movement, and that the same issues that are faced by, you know, privileged white women in a country like America or Australia, while the specific issues are different in African countries or in other places around the world, the basic sort of sexism that informs them is the same. And that was like a real sort of, oh, yeah, I get that now.
You were doing a lot of nodding when Ben mentioned that book. Was that important one for you as well,
Dylan? Bell Hooks was just, you know, an absolute, yeah, you say, light globe moment. You know, she totally transformed my mum and my, you know, way of thinking. She was amazing. She really was like throwing a rope for us to get out of a dark hole. You know, it was quite intense writing my mum's story with the intergenerational trauma, and she even attempted suicide because of reliving a lot of that trauma from the mission days. And so, you know, reading people like Bell Hooks, you know, reading Toni Morrison's work and others were just, you know, amazing in terms of getting us through.
Yeah. What about you, Zoe? What kind of people come to mind?
I feel like the people who have mostly influenced my ideas of feminism are white women through, and I'm not sure if it's through what I studied at school, and also just, and not just books by, you know, Germaine Greer and Simone de Beauvoir and Ariel Levy and those people, but through talking to my friends who are primarily white women about our experiences. So I feel like my experience and understanding of feminism is very small and very limited and very inward looking, which I don't really like. I don't really have a strong cultural understanding that I really want to hold on to, but for women in other cultures where there are traditions that are very important to carry on, I feel like there's more room for feminism to transform my life than maybe there is for women in other cultures, or how to change but keep things that are really important.
Maybe, I mean, that's a really interesting tension, what the role of tradition is in against feminism or informing feminism. Mm. What do you guys think?
Well, I think, you know, we all traditionally and even today, because a lot of us still hold strong, you know, to cultural beliefs, and we're cultural beings, that, you know, approaching things in a respectful way is enormously important. And, you know, we're just not one conglomerate of, like women. We come from many different language groups and many different areas. And so each of our belief systems and our customs have been different in terms of our history and what we've grown into. Even in the city, there's histories that we come from. So, you know, there's different approaches and protocol. And so I suppose it's about engaging and learning and respecting, you know, what each of those groups' belief systems are. And certainly, you know, I'd never see not playing the didgeridoo as oppressive, because there's other really important, you know, roles that we have as women. You know, we still go out to country and follow our dreaming cycles with the seven sisters that move across the sky when they go to sleep and wake up in the sky, where we go out and clean rock holes and, you know, engage in, you know, process and ritual that continues to enliven country. So every group's a little bit different. Other people are part of the stolen generation, and others so have grown up in a completely urban environment. So I think everybody's context is a little bit different. But I think what you've said about, you know, being open and wanting to learn more and being informed by, I think that's the formula.
Yeah, I think listening's really important, especially since I've grown up with perhaps a version of feminism that was very focused on wanting to have everything that men have and wanting to be able to do everything that men do. And I think that's changing a lot, but I think that's definitely what was sort of on trend in feminism when I was learning about it.
And I suppose the ultimate goal is, you know, an Australian society that's accepting that, you know, values equality, you know, and that we all have the opportunities, equal opportunities, to move forward together. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, the ideas around feminism, that's kind of at the crux of that. And there's so much diversity within it. It's just making safe spaces to be able to engage and ensure that everybody moves forward together.
And that was the events yesterday, Wednesday the 26th of June. It's now Thursday morning. The vote for Texas's new abortion laws was deemed void, validating Senator Wendy Davis's marathon efforts. This morning in Australia, we no longer have a female Prime Minister. Interesting times. Clearly, there's more to say, and we need your voice in the conversation. So we've changed our theme for next week's Breakfast Club. The theme is now, the politicians have lost us. Art, apathy, and hope. We will be gathering at 8 a.m. on Wednesday the 3rd of July at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. We hope that you can join us. Thank you for listening. If you want more information, you can visit nextwave.org.au. My name is Emily Sexton. We'll see you next time.